All rise. The Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Perry Gary presiding.
Go ahead and be seated. Good morning. All right, our first and only matter on this morning, the matter of the challenge of the candidacy of Amber Lynn Candelaria. This is docket number 55714. Mr. Polzenberg, did you want to reserve any time?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. 6 minutes.
All right.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Perry, before he begins, can we get a housekeeping matter out of the way? And that was the issue as to the ballot printing. See if that's...
Oh, yes. Did we get our affidavit?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Mary Miller on behalf of the Registrar of Voters, Attorney David Roger. I did electronically file that affidavit yesterday, which indicates that all the ballots on which this particular race appear, which is about 80% of the ballots in Clark County, we are holding up printing on that. We are into overtime hours at this time. Tomorrow is the last day that we can possibly wait and still make the federal deadline of April 23rd.
All right, Tracy, can you make sure that we get a copy of that e-file document?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chief, I have a disclosure to make, one that will not affect the process of this matter, but for the record and potentially for the last time, because I think enough time has passed, and Mr. Polzenberg and his office have appeared in front of me, notwithstanding the disclosure. One of the members of his appellate team many years ago was my court clerk. It does not in any way, I'm sorry, my law clerk. Prior status does not in any way affect my ability to sit with a fair, open, neutral, and impartial mind, but I do feel that until a bit more time has passed, I need to.
Thank you, Justice Sada. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Dan Polzenberg for the appellant. The main issue that we have today is addressing the constitutionality of and proper construction of NRS 4.010 and the Senate bill that gave rise to it, 2005's SB 234. This is, in quite a number of ways, a very bad statute. It suffers from a number of constitutional flaws. Let me address them first, and then after that I'll address what I propose an interpretation to try to set aside the constitutional issue as the law requires us to do if we can.
Can I interrupt you 1 second? How many of these constitutional challenges were actually addressed in the district court proceedings?
The equal protection was, the due process was, and the right to vote was. The single subject rule wasn't. You have to remember, under the expedited basis we were under, we filed the opening brief in the district court slightly more than a month ago. It was March 12th. And I realized we put the court, and the court has been incredibly understanding and fulfilling its duty in addressing this on an expedited basis. And I think I speak for everyone when I thank you for that. But having addressed it in such an expedited basis, even in the district court, that issue was not raised. But the law in Nevada is clear that constitutional issues can be raised for the first time even on appeal. I think I would be in trouble if I were raising it in my reply brief, but we did raise it in the opening brief, and at least the district attorney addressed that.
You give the notice required by Rule 44 of the Nevada Rules of Appellate Procedure to the Attorney General?
We gave the notice to this court, and then this court gives the notice
right,
to the Attorney General.
But you did give, yes. You give no docketing statement on that.
There, we did give Rule 44 notice, and I believe I saw the Attorney General served with the notice of oral argument from the court.
Thank you.
So, yes, because we are raising the constitutionality of an issue, Rule 44 requires us to alert this court to that so it can give notice to the Attorney General in case the Attorney General wants to appear. I imagine she's rather busy with some other matters at the moment. Let me address the thematic issue that I have here and why I think the big picture, why I think there's such a problem with SB 234. And that is that it tries to find some kind of middle ground when we're dealing with judicial elections. And I don't think we can find a softer, easier way. I don't think we can have the legislature come in and be paternalistic and say that, well, people aren't really qualified to make the decisions as to who should be judge and who shouldn't be judge. And so we're going to put additional qualifications and restrictions on who can be elected judge.
But isn't there ample authority to allow them to enact reasonable regulations?
Yes, there is. And the question is whether this is reasonable. And the question also is whether this violates due process when we're dealing with how the rural counties and how the more populated counties are being addressed.
But our Constitution, Article 6, Section 8, specifically says with respect to justices of the peace, yes, that the legislature shall determine,
qualifications.
Their qualifications.
I agree.
And that differentiates justices of the peace from other judicial officers per the Nevada Constitution.
And we've pointed out that the other parts of Senate Bill 234, which tried to put restrictions on district judges and Supreme Court justices, violate that provision particularly.
Well, that's on a different footing, and those are not at issue here. But just on justices of the peace, you would agree that the Nevada Constitution authorizes the legislature.
I agree.
To regulate their qualifications.
I agree, but I think there are more particular problems. And I'm raising this as a thematic issue, though. I think this is the issue that runs throughout all of the particular problems that I'm raising, is that the legislature can't look for a middle ground in addressing judicial elections. The people should decide. The people have a constitutional right to vote. And the people should decide what the qualifications are, absent some gross qualifications such as age.
Mr. Paulsenberg, Goodson versus State, in terms of non-lawyers running for the Supreme Court, 115 Nevada, there's two cases up in Washington upholding population sizes. How do you deal with those? And likewise, those were as a state constitution.
And some of those had to deal with districting. I don't question the fact that judicial districts can have different sizes and different populations. That's not the issue here. What I'm saying here is that we have vastly different qualifications under the equal protection argument that I'm raising. It was one thing before to have NRS 4.010 say you had to be an attorney in Las Vegas, but you didn't have to be an attorney in Tonopah. Now what it's saying is you have to be an attorney for 5 years. And there is no support in the legislative history for making that disparity even greater when the legislature enacted that in 2005.
So, in fact, I was just going to say, so if we knock Ms. Candelari off the ballot, we're saying to people in the state of Nevada that someone with a GED can, in a rural county, can hear a murder preliminary hearing, can do a civil jury trial under 10,000, and can hear a misdemeanor trial.
Yes.
But if somebody graduates from Harvard in their law review and they practice law for 4.5 years, they can't serve in Las Vegas or Washoe.
That's right, and that's just too great a distinction, I think.
Well, does it make any sense?
It does not make sense. And the legislature didn't even consider it in 2005. There is no discussion whatsoever. They talked about we need to have judges who have experience. We need to have judges who've had credit cards and homes and children, but they've never talked about the difference in 2005 between how we treat the populated areas and how we treat the rural counties. The legislature simply did not address it. Now, the DA's office comes in and says, well, there's justification for the disparity because we'd have trouble getting lawyers in rural counties. The legislature never considered that. They never even considered it. They never talked about it.
What level of review do you maintain should be applied to your equal protection argument?
When we have to do with the right to vote, Justice Douglas recently Nevada's for Property Rights talked about the flexible balancing test. I think under that type of intermediate scrutiny, we would be at the high end of that test because we're talking about a fundamental right.
But you're not asserting strict scrutiny applies.
No, I was working into that. I am asserting strict scrutiny. I think if the court decided it, I may have to concede it. But I've been the last 44 hours trying to figure out, I am convinced that strict scrutiny applies to the right to vote. Now, it doesn't apply to the right to run, but it does apply to the right to vote. And I think that calls into play in two ways. We're looking at strict scrutiny. I still think I pass an intermediate test, but I think strict scrutiny applies here. It's not narrowly tailored. If we're looking for people who have experience, well, first of all, I have severe problems with saying that the electors can't decide what is the sufficient life experience. But if we're looking at experience, they were simply looking at life experience. What they could have done, if you're looking for a few more years of life experience, is raise the age requirement. Instead of having it be an elector, 18 years old, you can raise the age requirement to 25 years.
Well,
and
as you know, the Ninth Circuit in O'Connor touched on this standard of review and essentially said it didn't matter whether it was strict scrutiny or otherwise. Why should we adopt a strict scrutiny test? And if we did, how would we distinguish the outcome in O'Connor?
The outcome in O'Connor was different. I don't think they addressed the issues involved here because they said they don't have to address whether somebody has to be a licensed attorney under state constitutional grounds. But
essentially, O'Connor says, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the determination of the qualifications of the judiciary is of such a magnitude that the determination made by the state will satisfy a strict scrutiny or even lesser standard of review.
Well, I don't think they were addressing in the same context. I think that in the Ninth Circuit and O'Connor didn't really address the issues that we have.
Could the distinction be because in that instance the right to run was being addressed as opposed to the right to vote?
The right to run is part of it. I also think we can distinguish the intermediate scrutiny in the property rights case, because there we were talking about the right to participate under public participation and initiatives. I think when we're actually talking about the right to vote, that strict scrutiny would apply. I also think that, and we've cited Justice O'Connor's concurring opinion in Republican Party versus White. I think that's a telling situation because that would go both to strict scrutiny and the idea that you can't have middle grounds.
Assuming the right to vote is implicated here,
is
that posted up where really the appellant is raising a question about the right to run?
Well, both this court and the United States Supreme Court have admitted they're interrelated. This court in the Governor Miller term limits case decided it on the people's right, although I represented the governor in that case. We argued and the court agreed that it was the people's right to vote. It wasn't just the right to run. In Nevada Judges Association versus Lau, this court said the right to run is not as fundamental. And there the analysis was also different from what we're talking about here. And if I had more time, I would go into where the argument in Judges Association was just, it's a bad idea to have term limits for judges. And this court essentially said, well, that's not a constitutional argument, that's a political argument. What I'm saying here is constitutionally, people get to decide what the qualifications are. Justice O'Connor, ironically, said in White that the state can't advocate that it has an important state interest in protecting the judiciary from real or apparent bias when it decides to have judicial elections. And I think the same thing would be said here. If the people of Nevada, through their constitution, have decided to elect the judges, we can't come up with some middle ground to protect the people from themselves.
But the people of Nevada have expressed in our Constitution that qualifications for justices of the peace are to be considered.
Yes, but the qualifications here go beyond. And I wouldn't be in here saying that it's unconstitutional to require justices of the peace to be lawyers. But two things. It's unconstitutional to put a... It's unconstitutional to have the distinction between rural counties and populated counties. And it's also really an issue. If you look at the legislation.
But a number of, you make that fair allegation, but a number of court cases across the country have said it's okay. And going back to your other statement, doesn't the elected legislature under the Constitution speak for the people?
Let me address that. I think that's the core of what I'm saying.
Oh, that's why I'm asking it.
They can't. They can speak for the people, but it's clear that the debate on this bill migrated into a discussion of whether judges should be elected or not, because SB 234 talks about all judges, not just justices of the peace. And it seemed to be this compromise. We want to protect the people from themselves.
But didn't they, as Justice Perry pointed out, didn't they have authority under the Constitution to enter that debate, to set qualifications?
Not that debate. They can set some qualifications.
Well, pursuant to the Constitution, the article that gives them that authority. They're not outside our state constitution.
Well, I think they are when they enacted SB 234. I'll give you two quick reasons why, address my main constitutional argument, and then get to the interpretation. The debate that they entered into was whether people should elect judges. And that is not for the legislature to decide. And what they enacted were paternalistic restrictions that only apply in some areas and other areas, which violates equal protection. But if the people want to change, we can't. You know, Bill Wilson said there isn't a softer, easier way. Half measures avail us nothing. If we want to change the judiciary, how we elect judges, the people should decide that. And the people should decide that judges are appointed. Let me go to my main
topic. You're actually chewing into your 6 minutes. Do you want to do that?
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
My main constitutional...
Mr. Pilsenberg, while you're chewing, make sure that you get to single subject.
That is right where I'm going. Thank you,
good.
Your Honor. What a brilliant transition. That's why I say that's my biggest argument. That's my easiest argument. Article 4, Section 17 says that any enactment by the legislature has to have a single subject. And here there were two different issues addressed. We had how long people had to be practicing lawyers for the Supreme Court, the Justice Court, and the District Court. And we also had a proposal to have a study for a Court of Appeals.
Now, let me ask you this. You didn't address the Wise case in your briefs.
Wise versus Bechtel?
Yes.
Well, Wise versus Bechtel went to the title.
Why isn't that applicable here?
There are two different issues under Article 4, Section 17, just as there are two different issues under 295.009, which applies the same standard to initiatives.
As to this, though, we're talking, and why we're centering on that, in the title, the first part is enacting law. The second part, a particular statute as to judges. The second part was just as to possibly doing a study.
It was to request the Supreme Court to do the study. Well, it's separation of powers. They weren't going to order you to do the study. I think they've learned from brutal experience over the years that they can't do that. But they were two different subjects. And that is, the Constitution requires two different things. There be a single subject, and there be an accurate title. The accurate title is to let people know what it's about. Now, I'll admit that the title conveyed that there were two different subjects.
Has this court embarked on two lines of competing parallel authority in the single subject area by addressing legislative enactments differently than the tests that we apply for initiative petitions? And if so, is this the case to reconcile those tests?
I don't think there have been, the court has certainly not addressed that there are two lines of authority. In fact, California in Perry versus Jordan, when it first addressed the idea of the initiative proposal having to have the same requirements, they applied the same standard to both. But, so I would say the same standards apply. The DA's office agrees that log rolling is one of the issues. They say it's not the primary one. The primary one is to let people, legislators and citizens know what's being voted for. So you can't have the federal Christmas tree where people hang all sorts of different things in there and give elected officials cover for voting for things. But I say they're the same thing. Look, Bernie Anderson, it's clear to me, and I said out in the briefs, voted for SB 2.
You say they're the same thing.
I think
you mean that the single subject requirements are the same for both, or do you mean that the test that we have used consistently is the same thing. I'm not so sure I agree with the second proposition.
I don't think, well, you have two different tests that you have applied under Article 4, Section 17. One, it most often comes up whether the title is accurate or not. It is rarely, but it has seldom
come. But hasn't this court, in at least three or four cases over the last 50 to 60 years, said, in reviewing single subject questions involving legislation approved by the legislature, that if the title is good enough, then the single subject requirement is satisfied. Whereas in evaluating initiative petitions, the court has examined the content of the petition to determine whether there are competing subjects within the content.
Now, if I hadn't looked at it that way, if that's what the court was doing, and that's why I told Chief Justice Parabury that I thought Weiser versus Bechtel was
That's my question.
If there are those two lines of authority, then I think that's incorrect. And this court should make clear that the single subject test is separate from the title test, and the court should look at the content itself.
Which we have not done previously, and therefore the second part of Justice Hardesty's question is this the proper case upon which for us to rest that determination?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. In the minute I have left, let me address the construction. Obviously, these are interesting and intriguing and challenging constitutional questions. But the law is that this court has to avoid a constitutional crisis if it can. And it can interpret this statute to have none of the constitutional issues come up just the way it interpreted the constitutional provision in the Governor Miller's case. And what I'm saying is when the legislature enacted, when it took the classifications of admitted to practice in any jurisdiction for less than 5 years, it took the classification right out of Supreme Court Rule 98. In statutory construction, there's no such thing as an accident or a coincidence. And so the pre-existing determination of what those classifications are, the legislature adopted at the same time. And that license for a year is licensed for a calendar year. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Could I ask one quick question, Mr. Pulsenberg? When you're talking about construction, we have two cases, one involving the legislature meeting after midnight, where we've said midnight really means 1 a.m., and we have the Miller case, which said 8 years really means 10 years. Can we apply that to the Candelaria situation here?
Yes, both of those, because here's why you can apply them. While the respondent's reading of the statute might be the ordinary reading that you would look just reading a statute, that's not what a court does. A court applies a statute to a set of facts. Nobody wondered what years meant under Article 5, Section 3, when we're dealing with term limits for the governor until the issue actually came up. And so this court had to say, well, what does years mean in that provision? In the context that it came up, it was Governor Miller could only be elected to one term if he served more than 2 years of someone else's term. So the court said, well, what does 2 years mean in the context of 2 years of Governor Bryan's term? Same thing here. The situation we're facing is, what does a year mean when the statutory provision says that you have to be licensed and admitted for not less than 5 years? Supreme Court Rule 98 tells us what licensed and admitted for a year means. It means for a calendar year, no matter what type, no matter how long within that calendar year.
Are we in our state law bound by the activities of the rules that refer to the state bar as to the interpretation, since they don't prorate years?
Yes, because at the time they enacted this language, the same classification, not coincidentally, appeared in the law, Supreme Court Rule 98. So when they enacted the same classifications, they enacted it with the same interpretation.
Is that governing law or merely procedural law?
Well, after governor versus legislature, I'm always afraid of that question. I would say,
that's no longer precedent, counsel.
I think there was improperty rights as well. I would have to think about that. I would think since it goes to, I'm tempted to say that that it could be procedural, but since it goes to defining the actual classification that was adopted in the by the legislature, I would have to say it's substantive.
Mr. Chief Justice, I have an additional question for Mr. Poulsenberry.
Go ahead.
The court continues to be placed in very difficult timing constraints in election challenge questions. Quite appropriately, the counties who are already stressed in their budgets express concerns about producing ballots and the like. Two questions. What alternatives are available to the court when presented with weighty constitutional questions that they may wish to reach in the context of these time constraints in election questions? And secondly, have you familiarized yourself with the federal law that council referred us to that requires the county to send the ballots out by April 23rd? And what are those consequences? And I intend to ask that question of the DA's office, too.
Second question first. No, I haven't reviewed MOVE. I did read Ms. Miller's affidavit with some interest. First question, I think it's possible to defer a lot of the questions. This court has an incredibly heavy burden and is very gracious to address these important questions, and they come up every year we have elections. And I know the citizens have to appreciate all that you've done. But what I suggest is what I had suggested in Governor Miller's case, is that the court simply issue an order and follow it. In that case, I believe it was quite some time later, with the published opinion explaining all the situation. And the order I would suggest in this case, for the time being, is the motion I made earlier for a stay. I don't know if you can wrestle with all these issues by the end of the day. And so what I would suggest is simply issue an order of Judge Bixler's, stay of Judge Bixler's order, which prohibits Ms. Candelaria from being on the ballot for the printing of the absentee ballots, and allow the ballots to be printed with her name on them. And then the court has until some time period before early voting starts on May 22nd to actually decide the issue. It would affect only then the absentee ballots. And then the court could decide before early voting started, and certainly before the primary. And I do think the court should follow this two-step approach, whether or not it agrees with me on the stay, because the court issued a very convincing opinion in Governor Miller's case and didn't follow that suggestion. Now, none of you were on the court that decided governor versus legislature, but the court hastened to publish two unconvincing orders in that case. And I think what you should do is announce the result and give the explanation when you've had time to give the explanation. Because I think a lot of the nuance of the constitutional arguments, and even the nuance of the statutory construction argument, which is required to avoid the constitutional argument, may be lost in a dashed out opinion. So that's what I would suggest. The court now issue a stay saying that that my client can be on the ballot for absentee ballots, and then address it with a little more time before early voting starts. Mr. Chief Justice, thank you very much.
Thank you. Colleagues, any other questions? All right. Thank you. Mr. Zadarowski.
Good morning, Justice Berger.
Good morning.
Please, the court. I guess from the start I should mention that with regard to the single subject argument and perhaps some constitutional arguments, I will be deferring to county council in this area. Not knowing exactly after reading the order where the court was going, I thought perhaps that I wasn't the best person to be arguing constitutional questions. Given my background, I'll take a crack at it and do the best I can. However, given the short time period, myself standing up here as real party in interest and being the challenger originally, I I think that I'm at somewhat of a disadvantage at this point. That being said, I'm more than happy to proceed and to do the best I can here. My original position and thinking that the court was concerned about these issues dealt specifically with the issue of what constituted 5 years and how much deference the court needs to be giving the state bar, and those particular issues that were addressed in Mr. Paulsenberg's opening brief.
Mr. Zasowski, do you want to comment on my 8 years really means 10 years and midnight really means 1 a.m.?
Yes, thank you, Justice Cherry. Specifically, I had argued in my brief that this is unambiguous, and part of the reason why I believe that it's unambiguous is because this court has decided for example, in Lau, that the determination of what years means, although it may mean a political year or an official year or a calendar year, no matter which way you slice it under the Lau decision, Ms. Candelaria is not qualified to be on the ballot. If you were to take a calendar year and say that from January 1st to December 31st, Ms. Candelaria in December of 2006 may have been barred, but she certainly wasn't barred at any time prior to the time that she was licensed, which was October 17th of 2006. So under that particular reading of Lau, a calendar year, she's not qualified. If you take a political year, no matter which way you slice it, a lunar year, it all requires the court to engage in this analysis based upon counting days, which from the record below, Mr. Paulsenberg's argument was that the Supreme Court needs to look at years without regard to days and months. Yet the language of the statute 4.010 requires you to look at days with regard to days and months and not just years. And so my argument is that under any reading of Lau, Ms. Candelaria would not be qualified.
Mr. Zadowski, going back to another issue that was raised, if we don't adopt strict scrutiny and we look at a rational basis, is there a rational basis for compelling this five-year requirement when at least we say rurals versus city, so to speak, attorney versus non-attorney, then we throw on another hurdle for attorneys to have to 5 years practice, but we allow people who are not attorneys, who haven't practiced law or been in law enforcement for 5 years, to execute the Office of Justice of the Peace. What's rational about that?
Clearly, the Office of Justice of the Peace and the determinations that they make in probable cause hearings and being the determiner of law and fact in misdemeanor trials is certainly not rocket science. However, I think the law does recognize a growing up of the legal practice in the state of Nevada. It recognizes that we should have legal expertise, especially in areas, urban areas. The law takes that into account, where there is much crime and the legal issues to be determined in these particular locales.
Mr. Zadowski, certainly you're not suggesting that the most serious of crimes that occur outside of the urban areas are somehow less challenging?
Absolutely not. Certainly not. However, I think this law takes into account the fact that it does not occur as frequently, and it takes into account the fact that there are fewer lawyers in those urban areas to deal with these particular issues. I think the law and the way that we have judges training for lawyers and for non-lawyers who practice in those areas is adequate. As I said, I don't think this is being a justice of the peace determining probable cause is rocket science, and that clearly non-lawyers have been able to do this over the years.
Then why do we need the five-year requirement?
The question of whether we need it or not, to me, is not the issue. The legislature, if they have the right to enact this, is the issue.
And whether that or not the question, do. What is the rational basis then for enacting it?
They also may have the right, but they certainly do have to make these enactments properly, being mindful of constitutional considerations, assuming you will agree with me.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, Justice Seda, I agree completely, and I think that the cases that have been laid out in opposition to the appellate's brief state very clearly, in not obviously in case law from Nevada, but case law from other states, which I think is very persuasive, states that have very similar constitutional enactments or legislative enactments have stated in their jurisdictions that it's appropriate to have and that does stand up to constitutional scrutiny. years of practice requirements that differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction within a state. So, and that's why I think that the rational relationship standard is appropriate, because it takes into account that the practical realities of practice in rural areas versus the urban areas. I hope that answers your question.
What about a senior justice of the peace from Tonopah or someplace that comes in to Las Vegas and handles a murder preliminary hearing? They could not even have a high school education, and they can handle it in this population of over 2 million people.
Yes.
You want to comment on that?
Yes.
As being rational?
Yeah, I think it's rational, and I think that given the practical realities, as Justice Cherry knows, very frequently justices of the peace from other areas would come into Las Vegas and do that. But I think, again, it goes to the question of standards. The rational relationship there is that the law recognizes that the practice in the urban areas, especially with the caseloads, et cetera, is such that you would want to have lawyers who are considered legal experts, for lack of a better term, making these determinations. It's not that they can't make the determinations. It's that what does the legislature want in this case, and as long as it's constitutional, they have the authority to do that.
Well, when I was a criminal defense attorney, not only did I squirm when we had a non-lawyer hearing a high-profile preliminary hearing, but I saw the DA's office also squirm a little bit. They were in the same frame of mind as me, that they wanted someone who was a lawyer. And they didn't care how many years the person was a lawyer. They only cared that he was a lawyer or she was a lawyer.
Agreed. Yes. So,
well, these are interesting, it seems to me, political debates. The question for this court is, how does this abridge equal protection? Why isn't equal protection threatened or abridged by these disparate provisions?
The disparate provisions don't breach equal protection because, again, going back to the standard that is required in this case, which is a rational relationship, the law itself, as I've explained, does bear a rational relationship to the goals that the legislature intended, which is to have expertise in the law, even where matters concerning probable cause hearings and misdemeanors.
Should this court follow the decision in O'Connor out of the Ninth Circuit that when judicial qualifications are being addressed, it doesn't matter which level of scrutiny applies?
I cited the O'Connor decision in my response as well, and I think the court recognized that it, as you pointed out earlier, that it didn't really matter what the standard was, whether it was a rational relationship. I took that to mean that even under a heightened standard of scrutiny, that the law passed muster, that being that those who were running for the Supreme Court had to be lawyers.
Yeah, the problem with the Ninth Circuit case appears to be that it states that without much analysis.
True.
I was wondering if you were writing an opinion for this court, how you might justify a statement like that.
I wouldn't look to O'Connor as the sole basis for making that determination. I would look more towards, for example, Benham versus Dreigert, which is just a Texas federal district court case. I would also look U.S. Supreme Court cases, which very clearly state, especially Anderson versus Calabresi, which states that, as we talked about earlier, while the decisions will inevitably affect, and I quote, individual's liberty, the right to vote and his right to associate with other political ends, the initial and direct impact of the candidate qualification regulation is felt by the aspirants for office rather than the voters. And I would look towards the more fleshed out cases that were decided by the U.S. Supreme Court and in other jurisdictions that address this issue, particularly with regard to the qualifications of judicial candidates and other candidates.
Mr. Sadarsky, if we cut to the chase on this whole issue, don't we come down to the fact that there's no definition of what years means in this piece of legislation, that we have, as Mr. Pulsenberg pointed out, Nevada Supreme Court Rule 93 as to what the bar talks about for years and what the Governor Miller case talks about for years, that the court seems to have a problem deciding how you calculate years.
Yes, that is, I think, the most important issue. It is the issue here. And I think if you look directly at the language of the statute, which states, because the issue that we're talking about here isn't just a question of does the appellant have 5 years. The question is, does the appellant meet the statutory requirements of NRS 4.010, which is very specific, which states licensed and admitted to the practice of law for not less than 5 years at the date of the election. I think in that.
So where do we go then to define admitted to practice for 5 years?
Licensed and admitted, I think we take the normal and ordinary reading of that to be the date of licensure as the district court determined, which is a particular date. And I think that's compelled because the ending period is a particular date. The statute says upon his election. The determination of upon his election has been determined by this court.
So your argument is that in this statute, the difference is that a starting point and an ending point are prescribed in the statute, and thus it's not ambiguous.
Not quite. This ending point is described in the statute, and I think, therefore, the starting point, a reasonable assumption can be made as to what the starting point is. I would also note
that. Well, isn't the starting point defined by licensed and admitted?
It is, and that's my point, but licensed and admitted, does that mean, according to appellant's argument, that the date licensed and admitted relates back to the first day of the year, not October 17th, 2006 here? I think that if you look at the
ending. Well, assuming the court didn't feel constrained by Supreme Court Rule 98's allocation of bar admission fees, would the statute be ambiguous?
It would not be. I think as a result of Lau and other decisions, the determination of what the definition of not less than 5 years means is clearly unambiguous. This isn't the statute that says 5 years. It says not less than 5 years upon his election. I would also note that if the court is inclined to give deference to the state bar and the state bar's interpretation of what this means, I would argue that Supreme Court Rule 98 does not interpret anything at all. It simply sets a fee schedule. If you want an interpretation from the state bar, if this court is looking to the state bar as to what they've determined to be appropriate, I think it's very clear that they should be, that this court then should be looking at what the Supreme Court, what the state bar has determined. There are panels. There's a Judicial Ethics Commission. There is a judicial discipline.
Well, there's an interesting proposition that exists that no one's really talked about much. Supreme Court Rule 98 isn't simply a state bar rule. It's a rule approved by the Nevada Supreme Court.
It is, but it is a rule.
We're not giving deference to anybody. We approve the rule.
Absolutely, and I think that gives this court and the lower court the right to interpret. I'm not saying I agree that the Supreme Court has to give deference to the state bar.
The rule as it reads should be interpreted in the manner suggested by appellant is a different question, but it really is a Supreme Court rule, one we enacted.
It is.
So the deference question is really, from my point of view, irrelevant.
I would agree. But I would also state that if there's anybody that has any doubt in the court today as to whether there should be any deference to the state bar, one should look to the bodies that interpret the Supreme Court rules for their opinions. And that would be the Judicial Discipline Commission and the Standing Committee on Ethics and Campaign Practices. In the latter, the committee did in fact interpret, not the Justice Court, and not with regard to 4.010, but they did in fact interpret the rule with regard to NRS 3.010 dealing with district court. They did that in Duffy versus Mascow. And in that particular case, the state bar determined there is a period of time here that you simply cannot count contrary to what the appellant is asking for here. And that means that licensed and admitted starts on a particular date. Once you are licensed and admitted to practice law, and no time before that can be counted. And I think that's contrary to the appellant's position here.
Mr. Zdrowski, you're at 4 minutes, and I know my colleagues and I are interested in hearing some of the constitutional issues that Ms. Miller was going to address. So I'm going to cut you off.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'd like to initially point out that I disagree with Mr. Polsinger's statement that there's nothing in the legislative history that addresses the divergence between the qualifications in the rural courts and the urban courts. On page 50 of the packet that Mr. Polsenberg submitted to you, the sponsor of this bill pointed out that this bill is about qualifications. There's a different qualification for the rural than the urban because in the rural areas, there are less opportunities for judges. This court also had the same concern in the Nevada Judges Association case where they were talking about the result that taking away experienced judges would have on the judiciary. And they noted also in that case that that would have a bigger detriment to the rules where there are less opportunities for experienced judges to take to act as public servants.
So even if a lawyer is in a rural area, if they don't have, if a lawyer in a rural area can be a justice of the peace even if they don't have the 5 years?
Under the legislative scheme that's before you today, yes. And that legislative scheme is a rational organization by the legislature. It's a rational exercise of their police power to set minimum qualifications for public servants.
What's rational about a lawyer less than 5 years in rural and a lawyer less than 5 years in Las Vegas or Reno?
Well,
what's rational about it?
The rationale behind that and the clear reasoning and the clear justification is that in the rural areas, a GP is faced with a complicated murder prelim or some type of complicated case by that with far less frequency than an urban JP would be. And the legislature balances the need of the citizens in rural areas for having a justice court relatively close to them being judged by somebody who is a member of their community. It's a balancing test that the legislature's engaged in, but it was a rational, reasoned basis. And when we're talking about equal protection classifications that don't impinge upon suspect classifications, it's not for us, this court, or for me as an individual, to second guess the legislature in the exercise of that reasonable exercise.
Aren't there a number of jurisdictions with the very same restrictions and requirements that have found that to be a reasonable restriction? And they've set forth a number of policy reasons, especially in the rural communities, for that distinction.
And spread across the United States. When this issue comes up before courts, and in the absence of constitutional prohibitions against the legislature from exercising that police power, the exercise of those qualifications are upheld when they do not present unreasonable restrictions upon classifications based on wealth, economic status, or the access to the ballot of minor parties.
Ms. Miller, are you going to get to the single subject analysis?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to point out, as Justice Douglas did, that the Wise case is really the leading and most recent direction from this court. And the Wise case says that the main reason behind the single subject rule is that we don't want to mislead the public or the legislature. But I would direct your attention to the legislative history in this case. Not only do the titles, as this case got, that this legislation got amended, clearly set forth what the legislature was contemplating, but if you look at the legislation, you will see that the sponsor of the legislation, as well as the chairman of the assembly committee, said that this legislation is about qualifications. We'd like the Supreme Court to weigh in on the various costs of a court of appeals, but they said specifically because we want to hear from the Supreme Court on what the qualifications should be. That's on, if I could direct you, that's on page 57. 62. They also heard testimony at page 57 from a member of the public that if you don't have adequately experienced judiciary, that places an undue burden on the appellate courts.
Ms. Miller, I asked Mr. Polsenberg whether this court has developed competing lines of authority when assessing the single subject rule issue in the context of legislative enactments versus initiative petition enactments.
I think,
as for example, in the initiative petition area, we have said we're going to examine the content, and in the pistol case, we said that once the court has identified the single subject, it will sever certain provisions which it deems to be not functionally related or germane. That test seems to be different than the Weiss test.
And reasonably so. I don't think they're competing interests. I think they're of necessity different interests, because when you have the legislature in session, as you see every day when you do your interpretation of statutes, the legislature has the opportunity to do the give and take. When you're talking about an initiative presented to the voters, they have no opportunity whatsoever for give and take.
So your argument would be that the court should maintain a different test when examining legislative single subject questions versus single subject questions raised by initiative petition. There are policy reasons for maintaining that difference.
There are important policy reasons, and I think this court always cites, when they're talking about a legislative initiative, a ballot initiative, the statute in 295 rather than going to the constitutional provision that governs the legislature.
Well, the terms of the Constitution on single subject are similar.
They're similar
to the statute.
But I think this court properly looks to the underlying dangers that the statute is looking to avoid.
Well, assuming hypothetically that the court were to conclude that the Weiss test should be revisited and that we would use or place an overlay of initiative petition tests on top of this, would the court then sever the requirement that we do the Court of Appeals study in order to save this if we found that the principal single subject was judicial qualifications?
If the court, the court could easily use that severance test. To be frank with the court, I don't even know if you can call the request by the legislature to this body to do a study legislation.
In fairness, though, I don't really feel like some of these issues have been adequately developed. And that's what, at least for me, is unsettling when we get these significant constitutional and legal questions in such a short amount of time. And that's no criticism of the lawyers, because you are operating under more difficult constraints than the court is, for that matter.
I share Mr. Polsenberg's gratitude for how this court expeditiously handles it, but it's a struggle for me to know what the best way to handle that.
Could you address the remedy question and the timing question that I posed? What are the consequences of the move federal legislation if you don't mail by the 23rd? And what alternatives are available to the court if it wishes to take more than 24 hours to try to resolve major questions like this?
I'm not sure about the ramification of the move case, because as you know, it was just implemented about 6 months ago. I think...
Does the legislation spell out any consequences to the state of Nevada or Clark County in not mailing by the 23rd?
I think it raises the possibility of overseas voters if they did not get the ballots in time to vote, and if we could demonstrate that there was enough. It'd be handled in the context of a traditional election challenge, which election contest rather, which we don't see that often anymore, but it could raise the specter of a federal law was violated, people were disenfranchised, is the Illinois election void? There are serious potential.
There has, in prior cases, we've had some authority cited to us that has said that the court can separate this particular election from the election and order a special election. Have you considered that type of argument?
I've considered that. I considered that when I made my objection earlier on this case to Mr. Polsenberg's request for expedited briefing, and I struggle with what the right answer is, because if you leave Ms. Candelaria on the ballot, voters may vote for her, and it may be determined down the road that she was not a qualified candidate. Their votes go to waste. If you leave her on the ballot and she's elected, and you determine that she's not a qualified candidate, then there's a need for an appointment process and a special election in conjunction with the next election. But I acknowledge the damage to Ms. Candelaria if you take her off. If you do not order a stay and say, these are important constitutional issues, we need more time, we're not granting a stay in this matter, she's eligible to run in 2 years beyond dispute. In the Clements versus Fashion case, the Supreme Court said a 2-year wait is not an unreasonable imposition on a candidate's rights. So I would like to be able to give you a definitive decision and say, Your Honors, this is the way to go, but I know it's a hard struggle to know what the right answer is, and I just don't have it.
Colleagues, any other questions? All right, then. This matter will stand submitted. Council, we commend you for the quality of work you've presented to us in such a short, expedited time frame. So thank you so much, and courts stand in recess until the next call of the